From the New York Times, this is The New Washington. I'm Michael Barbaro. Today, House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Now you have a presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. Will you support him?
To be perfectly candid with you, Jake, I'm just not ready to do that at this point.
Have we had our arguments this year? Sure we have. You and I call those signs of life.
But do you think he's changing anything?
I believe he's going to endeavor to try.
Republicans are committed to keeping our promise to lift the burden of Obamacare from the American people.
This is not a job I've ever wanted.
There's not complete consensus on how best to do health care reform. On tax reform, we have that consensus.
Nothing's going to derail what we're doing in Congress because we're working on solving people's problems.
Hey, Lane, how you doing? Nice pants.
It's one of those...
All right, you guys ready? All right, good afternoon. This is a historic day. This is a day that is a long time in coming. In fact, it was on this day, under this dome, in 1986, that Congress took the final vote on the last overhaul of our tax code. That long.
Carl Hulse, tell me about what happened earlier this week.
Well, the Republicans finally introduced their long-awaited and occasionally delayed tax overhaul, which really sort of starts the clock on whether they can get it through and how painful it's going to be.
This unified framework delivers a new tax code that is simple, that is fair, that is pro-growth and pro-family.
The president has called for them to finish this by the end of the year. Going to be really tough, you know, the House maybe by Thanksgiving. So the deadline is looming over them. They want to end the year with something really tangible to show there's a benefit to having Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And so far, they haven't had that.
We famously
We go to the same.
So you guys know we famously have our hair cut
by the same lady.
For
like the last 20 years.
She always keeps me up on.
You need to go.
Carl, you and House Speaker Ryan have known each other for some time, right?
Correct. As we've talked about before, Michael, Paul Ryan and I get our hair cut at the same place, which came up in the interview. And when we thought he might be picked for vice president, you know, we were sort of bugging Hannah, who cuts the hair. Hey, are you hearing anything? Or should we check in with you about, are you having to do an emergency haircut or anything? So
she would actually go out to like a hotel and come back.
I know. I remember.
They made her do that.
Oh. But I covered Congress full time. You know, he was an important figure in the Republican Congress. He was sort of the, in some ways, the brain center of House Republicans. He was the policy wonk. He was the guy coming up with the plans. He came out of think tanks. So people look to him for policy ideas.
Well, no one has been more passionate about what we're announcing today than the speaker for a longer period of time.
So in some ways, to me, this tax overhaul plan, outside of being elected speaker, is the biggest day in his legislative and political career. Is this like your crowning achievement here today? I mean, you've been trying to do this
for a long time. I've been working on this issue for a long time, since before I was elected. I've spent my young years working with tax economists on just these issues, and it's why I pursued the chairmanship of Ways and Means, was first and foremost to do tax reform. So, yeah, this is an issue. The reason I care about it so much is I see it can do the most good to the most number of people in one single reform of almost anything we could do in this country. That's why I care so much about it, because I could see it having such an enormous positive impact on pretty much all people in this country and the country itself.
So let's talk about the plan itself. What is Speaker Ryan trying to achieve with this tax reform proposal? What's his argument?
His big argument is that Americans, he called it, I think, goofy corporate tax policy at some point, penalizes American companies, isn't competitive, drives companies overseas, and keeps some of their money overseas. Hmm.
In Wisconsin, our biggest business used to be Johnson Controls, that was headquartered in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. They're an Irish company now. Why? Because they went and inverted, and now their global tax rate is 12.5% instead of 35%.
So they want to set up a tax system that makes it more attractive for American businesses to stay here.
We have a terrible tax system in this 21st century global economy that is putting American businesses at a massive disadvantage. I'll give you one just example. It's a big kind of ticket example. I met with the head of Intel. Intel, the corporation that makes, you know, the chips in our computers. They got 50,000 employees in America, really good paying jobs, factories spread across the country. They ran their numbers. They would save $2 billion in taxes alone per factory over less than a decade if they just moved those factories to other countries because of the U.S. tax code. So we are taxing businesses out of America. We're basically saying to companies, you shouldn't make your business here. Don't keep your business in America.
I think that's about two-thirds of the tax plan goes to a cut in the corporate tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
The other third goes to personal income taxes. And, you know, this array of changes in tax policy, Republicans intend to keep more money in the hands of Americans.
In our general philosophy, lower tax rates, get rid of the loopholes, let taxpayers decide what they want to do with their money. It is their money. And that act of freedom, that liberalization that people get from just being able to make their own decisions with what they want to do with their money, that's good for the economy, that's good for people.
So to be clear, it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut.
That's the cost of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't go beyond that to avoid a filibuster.
And of that $1.5 trillion?
About two-thirds, I've seen that, goes to the corporate tax cut.
You know, so we really believe that getting this middle-income tax cut and then getting our tax system so that it makes sense to stay in America as a business and hire Americans means we'll get more jobs and higher wages. And we'll give a break to people struggling in this country. And that's good for the economy.
And to hear Ryan describe it,
sure.
This is a middle-class tax cut. So what's the economic philosophy that turns a tax cut, the majority of which is for corporations, into a middle-class tax cut?
So the economic thinking is that just a thriving business climate is going to benefit people, create new jobs, increase wages, so they're going to gain that way. And there's a big disagreement of whether that kind of corporate tax cut actually, quote, trickles down,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the phrase to regular people. Republicans would argue, yeah, if businesses are thriving, they're going to have more jobs, spend more money, higher wages, so they'll benefit that way. But, you know, that's always sort of the big question mark here. Is it a middle-class tax cut or not? Middle-class people definitely benefit from this under a lot of scenarios, so they can call it a middle-class tax cut. But there is, you know, a bigger advantage for business.
But we got to take on interest groups. One of these interest groups does not like this because we're doubling the standard deduction, and therefore people are just going to get a tax cut instead of buying their product to get a tax cut. That's the kind of stuff we have to contend with. And that is one of the reasons why this hasn't been done for 31 years.
But it's hard to explain that.
Yeah, it just took me four sentences.
No, if you're
Carl, for the financially challenged, a quick quiz for you. What is a standard deduction?
So this is the amount that you get just right off the top of the bat for living. You know, so when you start doing your taxes, you get an amount just for being you and your wife and your kids. I think that they double that amount. So you're getting a higher standard deduction.
And by deduction, we simply mean the amount that you don't get taxed on your income.
Correct.
And your...
It starts lowering your income down to that taxable income level, which you do pay taxes on. However, Michael, I will not be doing your taxes this year.
That's too bad, because last year you did such a bang-up job.
You know, one of the other things they eliminate in here, actually, in getting rid of the deductions is the... deduction for paying someone to do your taxes.
Too bad.
I am surprised that you got rid of the medical deduction.
We are getting rid of itemized deductions, yeah. Except for charity and mortgages.
I'm already hearing some response like that's penalizing sick people.
We're letting people keep their own money. They decide whether they decide.
And Carl, some of the elements of this bill are pretty technically complicated. I want to focus on one of them. You and Ryan spoke of something called the medical deduction. Can you walk us through that?
So the medical deduction for people with extremely high medical bills, they can deduct part of those. You have to reach a certain threshold, which is pretty difficult to reach. And if you show that, you can deduct your medical expenses. So in some ways, that is for people who are pretty sick, you know, if you're going to pile up those kind of bills. And so they eliminate that. And I said, well, isn't that penalizing sicker people? And he said, we're getting rid of all these deductions. Mm-hmm. We don't want it. So we're not going to single that one out.
Here's what these deductions do. We raise your taxes and you pay higher taxes, but if you engage in a certain behavior, then you can use the deduction and get your money back. We're saying just keep your money in the first place.
Okay.
We're just saying we're going to lower your tax rates in the first place. You keep your money. You decide what you want to do. If you want it for medical expenses, great. For retirement, for a home, you decide.
So one just last thing, but it's a little broader question. You know, after you guys got the House back, you know, the Republicans are mea culpa. We spent too much. We slipped during the Bush years. You yourself said, you know, we lost the handle. As I said to him, you know, there was a lot of spending during the Bush years and Republicans led by him. You know, they offered mea culpa. We drove up the debt and the deficit. We won't do that again. So here they are again. But this is $1.5 trillion costs. I mean, is the deficit hawk days over?
No, because this is pro-growth, and we are convinced that we are going to make this up in growth. We have what we call base broadening, so we pay for, quote-unquote, right, a lot of this. But we are convinced, and a lot of economic models show us, that getting a more competitive tax system is going to get us a faster economy, and that faster economy will give us more revenues, more than to pay for these, for this we call static revenue loss.
So his argument, his classic economic argument, is like, this is going to spur growth. It's going to bring in more money. We can make up the cost that way. Hasn't really worked in the past, and we'll see what happens. I think that, and that particular issue is going to be a problem. Bob Corker in the Senate has said, you know, I don't want to do this if it's going to explode the deficit again. And the margin is very narrow in the Senate. So I think that is another continuing argument you're going to hear over the next, you know, months as this bill is fought out. Republicans seem to be more concerned about the deficit when Democrats are president.
We're a polarized country. I think one of the reasons why we're a polarized, high-anxiety country is because we've had pretty flat economic growth and pretty flat opportunity. Most people haven't got a pay increase. Most people, you know, half the people in this country live paycheck to paycheck. So there's a lot of economic anxiety. And I think this one of the key solutions is faster economic growth, more jobs. And I think the best thing we could do to deliver that is tax reform.
Now, not just the country that's polarized. Congress is polarized.
Yeah, everybody's polarized. Well, the Congress is a manifestation of the country.
And things haven't gone like you expected, I'm sure, in January when you're like, we've got everything. So how critical is it for you, Republican Party leader, to get this done?
Yeah, I mean, sure, for us, I think the political considerations should pale in comparison to just the policy achievements and what's right to
do. I knew you would
do
say that, by the way.
But no two ways about it, we said we would do this. You know, we better run on an agenda and be a solution party. We were, you know, during the Obama years, we were pretty much seen as an opposition party, just against. We had to be a proposition party offering solutions, what we're for, and we had to put together an agenda. And that was one of my conditions on taking this job. And in doing that, we spent all of 2016 assembling an agenda we called The Better Way. And I'd say the crown jewel of that agenda was tax reform, because we think that that's one of the best things you can do to get faster wage growth, higher living standards, you know, more jobs, and just a better competitive economy and a more confident America. And so we ran on doing this. And so now is time to keep the promise. So a promise was made, we won the election, and now we have an obligation to make good on our word and make good on our principles and make good on the things we said we would do to help people, and this is time to deliver. So yeah, we have to deliver.
Carl, on its own, how big of a deal is this proposed tax overhaul? When was the last time something of this scale was rolled out?
Yeah, this is a really big deal. And actually, the proposal they came out with was a little bit more sweeping, honestly, than I anticipated. Although I probably had low expectations. But the last really big tax overhaul was 1986.
When I sign this bill into law, America will have the lowest marginal tax rates and the most modern tax code among major industrialized nations, one that encourages risk-taking, innovation, and that old American spirit of enterprise.
The job I had then, I was working the quarter grill at McDonald's. So before waiting tables. So This has not been done for a long time.
And since then, it's proven very difficult to do anything beyond just cutting tax rates. And the reason is
because the special interests that protect the current code and the status quo have successfully managed to overwhelm the general welfare of the country, the general interest that you get when you do tax reform.
There's a huge infrastructure here in Washington, mm-hmm, the lobbying community, that exists solely to protect their tax breaks. And we're seeing some of that rear its head right now. And that's what makes it so hard. You know, there's some associations and business groups that are against this plan right now. The Home Builders Association, National Association of Realtors, the Federation of Independent Business, I think is the small business community's official name. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are really important lobbies for Republicans generally. These are people who always support Republicans in their communities. You know, every community has a home builder who's a big player or more, you know, realtors. So, you know, they're taking on some pretty powerful forces here. Well, let's see if they can do it. Ryan thinks they can. So is your personal legacy tied to the success of this bill?
I don't really think about these things this way. I'm more of a policy guy who just believes in ideas, and I don't like putting names around this stuff. But if you know me, you've known me a long time, you know this is the kind of thing I care about, and this is something that I've been fighting for a long time, and I'm very excited to be in this moment.
We'll be right back.
I've been thinking about this. I just wanted to ask you, and this is something that's always made me wonder about you. I mean, you used to be a waiter mm-hmm. over at the Tex-Mex place right down the street. Now you're elected here. You're the most powerful guy in the House. You were on the presidential ticket as the vice president. I mean, do you ever go back and think when you were over there bussing tables or whatever, it's like, whoa, how did this happen, right?
When I walked through the rotunda in the Capitol, I'm like, what the heck am I doing here? Yeah. I mean, I'm from Jeansville, Wisconsin. You know, I went to a small Catholic grade school and public high school and public university. I mean, I never thought I'd be doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's this great story.
Yeah, it really, I mean, I just wanted to be an economist when I was younger. So I was never one of those young guys thinking I was going to run for office. And then I got really into public policy. Jack Kemp was my mentor, really kind of got me into all of this. And one thing led to another, and opportunities presented themselves at home, and here I am. So believe me, in my family, no one expected that I would be doing something like this.
Carl, Speaker of the House, can we talk about that role for a second, kind of how it actually works?
Yeah, it's a really, really big job. It's the congressional job that is in the Constitution. He's second in line to the president. And there's a lot that goes into being the Speaker of the House. There's always talk around town that you're not loving this job that much. You know, John Boehner.
I think I've heard that for every speaker I've ever served with.
It is a very difficult job.
Yeah, it's a different kind of job.
And just to be clear, it's a job that you are elected to by your peers. So it's kind of a House popularity contest.
Yeah, and the full House votes on you. Of course, Democrats don't vote for Republican speakers. But, you know, they want the guy who they think offers them the best chance of leading to success.
I did it on a couple of conditions, one of which was that we have an aggressive agenda that we think is good and right and will help the country and go pursue that agenda. And I'm excited when we're pursuing this agenda. And that's what gets me up in the morning. And that's what gets me working late at night.
Paul Ryan was reluctant to do this for a lot of reasons. One, he knew it was tough. Two, he's got little kids. You know, he has an actual life back in Wisconsin. But you think you've pulled that off?
Yeah, I don't travel weekends. I'm home on weekends.
Yeah, because, you know, the speaker's typically an old
guy. Yeah, John Boehner once told me he didn't make it home for about 3 or 4 months straight. And that's just crazy.
But you go to your kids' soccer, baseball games.
Soccer games, it's basketball season now. Yeah, I'm doing soccer, basketball, all of that. We just finished cross country. So, yeah, I spend my weekends at home. Just like other members of Congress do.
Let's talk about Ryan's relationship with President Trump. During the campaign, you could almost feel Ryan's discomfort at various moments when the president said something or did something or was accused of something.
This is the party of Lincoln, of Reagan, of Jack Kemp. And we don't always nominate a Lincoln and a Reagan every 4 years. But we hope that our nominee aspires to be Lincoln and Reagan-esque.
And now, as Speaker, he finds himself working pretty closely with Trump and generally reserving criticism of him. And that has prompted the criticism, somewhat unique to this president, that the House Speaker is an enabler of Trump.
Yeah, obviously, the campaign with Trump was problematic for Speaker Ryan, you know, that famously came out and said that he wasn't ready to support him. How would you characterize your relationship with the president now?
It's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really know. I wouldn't say we had the best relationship in the campaign, but we've gotten to know each other extremely well since then. Like I said, I only talked to him once or twice in 2016, but we talk frequently, and we have a common mission and a common shared agenda that we're working really hard to try and achieve.
So you were with the president today. I'm sure he's excited about the tax bill. Jeff Flake, you and Jeff Flake have a lot in common.
He's a friend of mine.
Yeah, he called out the president last week. I think he's hoping other people would call him out. But you don't see that as your role
here. I don't see why we would want to start a circular firing squad in our party when we have an opportunity that's almost a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make a big change for people's lives.
Here's Jeff Flake, a person who's a friend of Paul Ryan's, worked together with him, shares a lot of ideology. You know, and Jeff Flake kind of went out on the Senate floor and called out other Republicans. We can't do this.
The personal attacks, the threats against principles, freedoms, and institution, the flagrant disregard for truth and decency. None of these appalling features of our current politics should ever be regarded as normal.
The way I look at this, and, you know, Jeff and I have our differences on this, that's not what people voted us in to do, is scream and yell and call each other out and you know, get into these shouting matches. They elected us to fix their problems, not grouse about, you know, personality differences. So I honestly believe my job as a congressman from Wisconsin, Speaker of the House, is to focus on the problems of the people we represent and try to solve those. And starting a circular firing squad in our party and yelling at each other doesn't get anything done. And I want to get things done.
But you think the trade-offs are worth it. Obviously, you've been unhappy.
I don't even see it as a trade-off. I just don't think it's productive, and I don't think it's useful, and I don't think it helps the country. That's my point.
You know that that attitude drives some people crazy who think you should
I know they do, because I noticed it's mostly from people who don't like the agenda I'm pursuing in the first place.
So you think it's mainly political?
Well, I mean, Jeff and I agree on much of this agenda, but I just disagree with his style. I don't think that that is productive. I don't think it's constructive, and it's not going to help us get things done for the country.
Obviously, he does not think at this point that anything the president has done or said is somehow disqualifying or was at a point that would cause the speaker to withdraw any support for the president.
Big things are hard to do, and we have a razor-thin majority in the Senate, which makes things hard to do. So big things are tough to do. Tax reform for the first time in a generation is hard to do. Healthcare reform is an emotional issue. It's a divisive issue, but it's an issue we're going to still have to keep tackling because it's just not working, meaning the system. And then we've got a lot of other work to do. I think infrastructure is something we can make a good difference on. I think career and technical education. I think moving people from welfare to work. I really do believe that for the rest of the session, there are going to be some bipartisan opportunities for us to get some things done and to really make a positive difference.
Carl, you, at the end of the interview, asked Ryan about whether his members had the courage to get this bill through. What did you mean by that, and what did he say?
What I meant was they're going to have to take some tough votes. They're going to have people who have given them money, other special interests, maybe in their community as well as in Washington, say, hey, you can't vote for this. You know, this is really going to hurt us. And they have to be able to look at them and say, overall, I need to support this bill despite some damage it might do to supporters like you, that the overall benefit is greater than the pain you might suffer. That's a really tough vote.
Going to take some courage by some of your guys.
It is. It is.
You think they're up to it?
I do. But I honestly believe if we actually do what we said we were going to do and we solve people's problems and we help people get some economic confidence and some security in their lives, I think we're going to be fine.
So what happens if you don't, though?
I'm not going to let that happen. We got to get it done.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you, Michael.
Washington is produced by Michael Simon Johnson and Michaela Bouchard. Brad Fisher is our engineer. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. That's it for The New Washington. See you back here next weekend.